This is a podcast of ABC Radio National's The Religion Report. This program can be heard broadcast or streamed from ABC Radio National. Details of frequencies, times and more downloads, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to The Religion Report for the 28th of December 2005. David Rutledge with you. And welcome to the second in The Religion Report's summer series of highlight programs from 2005. We begin this week with a distinguished campaigner for peace and ecumenism in Northern Ireland. The Reverend Dr. Ken Newell is the current moderator of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. He's also minister at the Fitzroy Presbyterian Church in Belfast. And for three violent decades, he's been closely involved in dialogue between Protestants and Catholics in the troubled province. In 1981, Ken Newell initiated a formal fellowship between his church and a Catholic church in West Belfast. It was a pioneering move, and the two churches' initiatives included visiting the families of people in Belfast who had been murdered and bringing paramilitary groups together for dialogue at a time when prospects for any political solution to the Troubles seemed completely hopeless. Well, since then, dozens of other Protestant Catholic fellowships have developed and fostered a slow but significant influence for peace throughout local communities in the province. I asked Ken Newell if there had been any particular defining experience that led him to take up the cause of conflict resolution in Northern Ireland.
Yes, there was. I'd grown up in Northern Ireland, and I'd grown up in exclusively Protestant tradition, and I had no Catholic friends until I was 18, and that's quite normal for many people in Northern Ireland, not totally, but for a very large number. And then the day before I went to Indonesia, I was downtown shopping in July 1972, and 20 bombs went off around Belfast in a period of 1 hour, and I was within 150 metres on that Friday of the Oxford Street bus station. 9 people were blown to pieces. They were picking their body parts up from an area of about 200 or 300 metres. 130 people were injured, and my car with everyone else's was locked into a traffic jam, and people were panicking. It was just like 9/11 to some extent. It's called Bloody Friday. And in that traffic jam, as I heard the bombs go off, and especially the one close to me, I made a prayer. I said, Lord, if I ever come back to Northern Ireland, please help me to try and find where the tap of violence is flowing from, and to put my hand on it with my other friends who would want to do that, and see if we can turn it off. So I had that sort of private prayer in the car the day before I left for Indonesia. And when I returned to Northern Ireland in 1976, I started to engage slowly, but with internal a determination in trying to find a way to forge peace and to move away from violence.
There must be some within the Presbyterian Church in Ireland who believe that any contact or dialogue with Catholicism is a perversion of Presbyterianism. And to what extent are you a divisive figure within your own church or within your own denomination?
Well, that's a very good question. I never see myself as divisive. I see myself as inclusive. But I know that whenever you start developing what's called controversial friendships in Northern Ireland, especially with Catholics and with people who are coming from paramilitary backgrounds, that can be so easily misunderstood. Again, if you read the Gospels of Jesus, what's really interesting is he also got into trouble for his controversial friendships. He befriended people who were non-Jews, people like Samaritans. He befriended people who were Gentiles. He befriended people who were outside the pale in terms of moral respectability. And he got into a lot of trouble for that. And I think if you are in a society that is deeply divided and where religion itself has been divisive for four centuries, and you try and reverse that and build bridges, you're going to take a certain amount of flack. And I have taken some flack over the years. But I really believe that this is the message that Jesus has bequeathed to us. It has captured my spirit, and I'm trying to live it out as best I can in Northern Ireland. I don't stand in judgment of other people's living out their faith in their own way. But this is what the Gospels mean to me, and I have committed my life to living this way.
I guess it would be true to say, though, that many Protestants have for a long time understood the peace process as representing the threat of a nationalist victory, in spite of the fact that everybody wants an end to the violence. How comfortable are Protestant communities with the evolution of the peace process since 1998?
Well, as you know, at the time of the Good Friday Agreement, I think it was something like 45% of Protestants did not feel comfortable with it, because usually where there's change, like in Rhodesia, South Africa, Namibia, other countries where people move into a more balanced community, the dominant groups always fear losing their influence and power. And there's an element of that, a reluctance to change. But the Protestant community have also had to face major changes to the police, which has protected them through 30 years of violence. Now, that was difficult. Releasing prisoners through the Good Friday Agreement was really, really hard to swallow, because many of these people were returned to towns and villages where they're walking past the families that they have devastated. And therefore, that was hard to swallow. But on the nationalist side, Catholics have had to swallow the fact that instead of boycotting, certainly Republicans not wanting anything to do with Stormont and Belfast, they started to take up responsibility in the local government in Northern Ireland. They've also had to commit themselves to the principle of consent, where they would not use violence in any way to force other people's political opinions. And therefore, both sides have had to swallow. But there had been a growing sense within the Protestant community that they've had to swallow more. And most of the advantages have gone to the nationalist Republican community. And there's an element of truth in that. But the big thing is, we all have to make adjustments and changes if we're going to have a successful relationship. Suppose it's like a marriage. Unless you're prepared to make changes that will accommodate the partner you're living with or the person you're sharing your life with, you're going to run into major difficulties. And so accommodating, being sensitive, being open to change, these are things that face us all.
How deep do you think the resentment goes when Ian Paisley, for example, said at the end of last year that the IRA should be made to wear sackcloth and ashes? To what extent was he echoing a popular Protestant sentiment?
He always echoes very popular Protestant sentiments, and certainly the IRA has done a huge amount of damage. You've got to remember also that there has been a huge amount of damage inflicted on the Catholic community through paramilitary groups. And if anyone's going to wear sackcloth and ashes, then it has to be all of us. And I think Dr. Paisley, myself, our churches, the Protestant community, everybody in Northern Ireland, Protestant and Catholic, have to look into their hearts and say, how far did I contribute to the continuing of negative attitudes that are based on prejudice and hatred and animosity and emotional distance from the other side? And when you do that, as Jesus once said, let him who is without sin cast the first stone. Sackcloth and ashes are for everyone.
Do you think that there's a sense in which Protestantism in Northern Ireland has traditionally been more about negative definition? You know, we're not Roman Catholics, we're not Republicans, we're not ecumenists. And that now that the political situation is becoming more about dialogue and mutual accommodation, it's left many Protestants with some really fundamental questions about their identity. If we're no longer anti-Roman Catholic, then what are we? Do you think that's a significant issue?
I think that's a very accurate analysis of the Protestant soul. It has been defensive. It has been tended to be negative. It looks at the Catholic Church, and the first thing it sees is the things it doesn't agree with. But if you look at communities or other faith or political groupings, and you ask yourself, the first question you ask yourself is, what do I admire about them? Then you'll see things in them that are very positive. And the Protestant psyche at the moment is in transition. More and more people are trying to recover the kind of internal confidence that can help you to look at the other tradition and begin to realise you have a lot in common with it, and also that there are things in that tradition that you admire and that are going to be helpful to build a new future. And again, it's like basic relationships at home. You can live with someone and be constantly trying to improve them or correct them or change them, and that's based on a negative evaluation of them. But if you get up in the morning, look in the mirror and say, Lord, today I'm going to try and love the person who's sharing my life, then you'll begin to notice their sensitivity, their kindness, their generosity, their perhaps shyness, their faithfulness and devotion. You see more if you sort yourself out first.
And how can the churches take the lead in that process? I was reading an interesting comment from the Irish primate Robin Eames the other day, and he was saying that for decades the role of the Protestant churches has been to offer pastoral support to victims of violence, to condemn the violence and to call for political action. And now that political action is underway, he says that the churches are less confident about what to do or how to take the lead. Do you agree that that's a significant problem, and how do you think it should be addressed?
Well, I think the churches definitely have been wonderful pastors, because our people have been hurting. I mean, there's nobody in Northern Ireland who doesn't have friends, family, relatives who've been killed. I have friends who now limp on a wooden leg, you know, or an artificial limb. I have people who've been involved in the loss of their husband, wife, or their son or daughter. And you can see the need for a pastor. You can see the need for a friend to come alongside and be supportive. where ministers and priests need to move is being prophetic, is where they, and that's a difficult role to play, where you say that it doesn't have to be like this. The church has to be more than just a pastor and heal wounds. It has to create an atmosphere where those wounds are no longer inflicted through animosity and hatred. So the atmosphere has to change, and it has to become an atmosphere where we start to trust each other, befriend each other, and learn how to love and appreciate each other. And it is coming without any doubt. There's a warmer environment in Northern Ireland than has been there for four centuries.
I suppose there's always been confusion in Northern Ireland over Protestantism as a religious entity and Protestantism as a party political force. How important do you think it is as the peace process develops that the churches should establish independence from political identification?
Well, it's very hard to establish complete independence because our churches, I mean, the Presbyterian Church in Northern Ireland is the largest Protestant church, and 95% of our people feel British and Unionist. So it's impossible to be independent and create separate identities. But what you do is you can reshape your identity so that it becomes much more inclusive, and especially if it's attached more to the vision that God calls us into as a community that actually functions well, where prosperity is shared widely and where opportunity is given to young people from all the communities. Where as a Protestant church, as you enunciate a new vision, then you can bring your communities forward into a much better future. But I think it's almost impossible to separate them out. But they can be self. I think the most important thing is that the faith should encourage you to reflect on yourself, admit your weaknesses, and also respond to a better vision of how to live. I don't think you'll ever get them independent, but they can become a force for rebuilding rather than creating further division.
The Reverend Dr. Ken Newell, peace activist and moderator of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. And on ABC Radio National Summer, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web, you're listening to The Religion Report. Next up, an Australian expatriate. Venerable Robina Courton is a Tibetan Buddhist nun. She was born in Queensland and grew up in a large Catholic family. At one point, she entertained thoughts of becoming a Catholic nun. Today, she lives in the United States, where she's the director of the Liberation Prison Project, an organisation that takes care of the spiritual needs of more than 3,000 prison inmates in the US and Australia. The Liberation Prison Project offers support through a network of visiting teachers and correspondents, as well as distributing books and videos on Buddhist teaching. I asked Robina Courton to explain the philosophy that she takes into the prisons.
Well, there is an approach where you learn to transform problems into the path, you know. And we all know in our own lives, when things are going well, we don't really look at ourselves. We just kind of bop along and there's no big drama. But when something goes wrong and we lose our job or our husband dies or someone leaves us or we lose our money, then we start, if we're courageous enough, we can start to use that as a wake-up call. And that's definitely what I'm seeing with people that we know, say in the US, certainly from my own personal contact and from the thousands of letters we've received over the years. It's almost like their mantra, you know, this has been my wake-up call. And that you're very brave to do that, I think. And certainly we're in the US, where the prisons are really overcrowded, very vindictive, very ugly places to be in, you know. So you've got to have a very strong mind and a very strong will, I think, to do that. But we're seeing that that's exactly the people we're dealing with. That's what they're attempting to do.
Buddhism has this interesting moral framework, particularly when it comes to the concept of evil, where, unless I'm oversimplifying, a person's acts are spoken of as being unskillful rather than morally bad or evil. And to what extent are you teaching prisoners to understand their own crimes in that way, as unskillful?
Well, I know, you'd say it this way, but there's nothing, I mean, in the different traditions of Buddhism, of course, as you know, and they speak in different ways, essentially the same thing. But from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there's no problem with the word morality. I mean, morality is fundamental. In fact, you could say that's really what the view of karma is, you know, which is sort of the creative principle in Buddhism, that whatever we do, say, or think leaves imprints or seeds in our own mind that produces ourself, literally from day to day, and of course, as Buddha would say, from life to life. And that the positive states of mind are what produce happiness for myself and therefore cause me to be kind to others, and the suffering states of mind, and we all know those, anger, jealousy, depression, which bring kill, lie, steal, and so on, they're the ones that just naturally produce a suffering me and produce suffering for the future. So the bottom line of the wish to practice morality in Buddhism isn't the usual religious view, it's because someone told you to. That's a very crucial point, actually. So in relation to that, how we work with prisoners. I mean, they're people who are, in one sense, exactly like you and me, and but maybe some of them have done actions that would appear to be worse than the actions that you and I would do. And let's face it, many people in prison probably are there because, you know, it's an accident. I mean, many people are in prison, you know, they've got wrongly accused, whatever. And certainly many people who aren't in prison are pretty heavy duty. So the way we would work with anybody who's attempting to use Buddhist tools is to, especially for prisoners, to encourage them to see that they've got extraordinary potential, but not to define themselves by the bad things they've done, which of course is what they would do because prison does that. It reinforces. And I can see it can be incredibly depressing. I mean, the low self-esteem and the self-hate that we would see in the people we know in prison is extraordinary. And so by helping people see their own potential and knowing that they can take responsibility, not to define yourself by the fact that you've killed somebody or stolen. Yes, you might have done that, but take responsibility. Know you, and know it doesn't define you, and therefore know you can change. That's the heart of it, really.
On that question of taking personal responsibility, though, if you take a serious criminal who has a background of poverty and abuse and violence, as so many do, virtually from the day they were born, a lot of people will argue that the responsibility for the crimes they commit is social rather than personal, and people who never had the remotest chance of being anything other than angry and disturbed and violent.
So when you say responsibility, social responsibility, you mean it's the responsibility of others that they're like that?
Responsibility of others and of their circumstances.
No, I understand. Well, I think there's no contradiction, you know. I mean, the Buddhist approach would be that things are interdependent. So I have to look at the way I was brought up and what the Catholic nuns did and what society did to me in order to learn about myself. But finally, the Buddhist one is that only goes so far. You've got to look at the very tendencies in your own mind. And of course, the crucial point here would be the materialist view is that society or environment or parents made you, literally created you this way. I mean, your parents literally create you, according to the Western model. But the Buddhist view would be your mind is your own, and that it's come from before. And the imprints within it, the tendencies within it are literally yours. So there's a very real reason in Buddhism to literally take responsibility for your own actions. So in the Buddhist view would be, yes, external conditions, of course they play a major role, but they're not the only thing. The crucial one is the tendencies within yourself. And so through using meditation and much self-awareness, you can learn to see there's a tendency to lie, steal, or whatever it might be, and then have the courage to know that it doesn't define you and you can change it.
When you say that the existence of the mind pre-exists your social circumstances, yes, you're talking about previous lives.
That's right. Yeah. That's fundamental. If you look at the big picture in Buddhism, Buddha says very precisely there is, you know, that he doesn't talk about a creator. You know, if I'm a materialist, well, my mum and dad are my creator, aren't they? And if I'm a religious person, God is the creator. But the Buddhist view would be that, speaking loosely, that I am my own creator in the sense that my consciousness, which is not physical, according to Buddhism, exists at the moment before conception. And the moment before that is this kind of continuity of mental moments. And then there's law of karma, which is cause and effect, which is all the things I do, say and think, leave imprints, if you like, in that mind stream that then will ripen in the tendencies that I was born with. Hitler's tendencies, Mother Teresa's tendencies. I mean, Buddha would say very clearly they were not made by their parents. I mean, pity help poor Austrian housewife if she's the cause of Hitler, you know.
I read an interview with you in which you said that part of your message to prisoners is that their physical incarceration is essentially nothing compared to the prison of attachment and ego and pride that ordinary people spend most of their lives caught up in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might want to qualify that. You
know, okay,
if I was a prisoner hearing that from a free person who could walk out of the jail at any time, I might feel that was a highly audacious claim.
No, it's true, it does. It's actually, it was quoting one Tibetan Lama, one of my teachers. I asked him to write a 21st birthday card to one of the young Mexican ex-gangsters whom we'd worked with in the past. He'd been in prison since he was 12. You know, just a scenario that's very common for a lot of young American boys anyway. And there he is, and he's sitting in his little cell 23 hours a day with virtually nothing and no freedom and no light and no sun. So it's a pretty intense environment of suffering. And then Rinpoche said to him in his postcard, yes, he said, your prison is nothing in comparison to the inner prison of ordinary people. It is quite an intense statement. But what I think is very interesting, the people that we know in prison who are working on themselves very deeply, they really can see this themselves. They come to this conclusion. And I think this brings us probably to the deeper level of, or the more subtle level of suffering that, you know, in the ordinary view, we tend to think of suffering in the gross sense, being in prison, being in a war zone, being poor. Rich people who might have depression, and we just look at them scathingly and think, oh, who do they think they are to say they're suffering? But, I mean, mental suffering, this is the Buddhist one, the deeper level of suffering is mental suffering. look at the incredible suffering of ordinary people in so-called rich Australia, rich United States, you know. The people are free of the gross suffering, but have intense mental suffering. And look at the harm we do on the basis of this. We kill people and do the most appalling things out of depression, out of anger, out of rage, out of, you know, attachment. So I think looking at it carefully, it really does make sense, actually. Although, you know, it could sound extremely arrogant being said in the wrong context.
But I suppose there's almost a Christian sense in which then a prisoner in jail, having been stripped of all his or her worldly attachments, is actually closer to enlightenment, closer to God. Do you see it like that?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it's a question of what you do with it, isn't it? Finally, it comes down to what we do with it. So I can see the people we know in prison whom we've worked with over the years, people who've come from the most appalling suffering and have no friends and no money and are poor or working class or whatever, you know, and that's the most we hear from. And we don't hear from the Martha Stewarts, believe me, you know. It's mostly the young gangsters and black guys and the Latinos that we hear from, people who you wouldn't think would be interested in some spiritual path. Yeah, you can look at lots of people who are poor and they're certainly not closer to God or closer to their spiritual practice because they don't know how to use it. And you can see people who maybe are mega rich who are very spiritual and compassionate. But in general, you can say for sure. And again, this is wake-up call business. The guys we know who are really practicing, the people we know are really practicing, they really see it this way. They are so grateful not to have all the responsibilities and the other things, and they're using this time as much as possible. And many, of course, have it for the rest of their life, so they can't have a fantasy of freedom after this, you know.
How many of them are there who are really practicing? Do you find it's a really successful enterprise?
I honestly haven't done numbers, what percentage of people continue to practice and so on, because it's a constantly ongoing thing. But I can only say we've had incredible numbers of letters that really do inspire us and really prove to us that it's well worth it, the need is really there. And it's just this small amount of human contact even, which our letters give, is just extraordinary. I mean, in fact, we read last year in the US somewhere that there's some evidence to show that a person in prison a year before his release who has contact with just one human being outside is 6 times less likely to reoffend. And I can see that's the major thing we're offering, which is this human contact. I mean, some are more advanced practitioners, some just like to read a book or two, but really the constant thing is that you've got one human being who is just supporting them and saying you're doing a great job and yes, you're doing well and yes, it's okay and yes, you've got potential and yes, you can change. And that's what's amazing.
Venerable Robina Courton, Buddhist nun and director of the Liberation Prison Project. Finally this week, a distinguished visitor from the Philippines. Her name is Amina Rasul, and she's a human rights activist, a former presidential advisor, and director of the Philippine Council on Islam and Democracy. In the southern Philippines, on the island of Mindanao, a war has been going on for 20 years between government forces and armed separatist groups, such as the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. In 1993, the conflict took a more sinister turn with the appearance of the Abu Sayyaf group, which has conducted a campaign of bombings and kidnappings. And since September the 11th, 2001, this has drawn the Philippines into the so-called global war against terror, with the United States taking a keen interest in purported links between Muslims in Mindanao and foreign terrorist organisations such as Jamaa Islamiya and Al-Qaeda. Meanwhile, in spite of a nominal peace deal that was brokered in 1996 between the government and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, the war goes on, and the social and civil fabric of Muslim communities in the southern Philippines continues to deteriorate. Amina Rasul was born and raised in Mindanao, so how does she feel the situation in the southern Philippines is progressing?
Not doing too well. The patient is very sick, David. We thought after the signing of the 1996 peace agreement between the government and the Moro National Liberation Front that things would change, that development would come and poverty levels would improve. Unfortunately, 9 years after the signing, poverty levels are as bad, if not worse. Education indicators are dismal. Our Congress cannot provide the autonomous region with the funds that it needs to be able to implement development projects. And then, of course, after 9/11, you have a focus now on military solutions to conflict resolution. And we keep forgetting that in order to resolve conflict, you must go to the roots of the conflict itself.
And what are the roots of that conflict? I mean, this is often portrayed as a religious conflict. Is it indeed a religious conflict or is it something else?
It's something else altogether. You know, in the 60s and the 70s, the Muslim provinces of Mindanao were not basket cases. In fact, we were perhaps more developed than some of the Christian provinces that are now way, way ahead of us in the development scale. What happened? In the early 70s, former President Marcos pointed to insurgency in the south. He said the Muslims were going to secede. He brought in the military, and by so doing, created conflict. You know what I mean? So in many ways, former President Marcos may have been responsible for the very situation that is now haunting us. Before martial law, Muslims and Christians in the Muslim areas got along well. After martial law, when the communities started to be divided, then you had politicians, you had rebel groups who would now use the banner of religion to bring people to come and fight for their causes.
We've seen the Philippines, rightly or wrongly, become one of the fronts on which the so-called war against terror is being fought. As you know, a US diplomat recently said on Australian television that Mindanao is at the risk of becoming the next Afghanistan. Now, that's a fairly dramatic claim. Is he correct?
In many ways, he is correct. In the areas of conflict, rule of law is breaking down. There is no respect for institutions of justice because the institutions for justice are ineffective. Our police are undermanned, under-equipped, ill-trained. So when this happens, then you start looking at a situation that may be reminiscent of an Afghanistan situation. Now, this is not true for the entirety of Mindanao, but for some of the areas of conflict.
How significant is the terrorist threat in Mindanao? If we take, for example, a group like the Abu Sayyaf group, how serious a threat to global security is Abu Sayyaf?
I'm glad you asked that question, because that is a question that Muslims also keep asking. When the Abu Sayyaf first came to existence and to the attention of the Filipinos, even at the time, they were not a sizable group. With the effectiveness of government in running after the Abu Sayyaf, their numbers have been decimated. Their leadership have been captured or killed. So the Abu Sayyaf is a spent force. Second, the Abu Sayyaf does not command the support of the communities because they have been responsible for heinous crimes, not just against Christians, David, but they have committed heinous crimes against their own, against members of the Muslim community. So there is no support there. So for these two reasons, the Abu Sayyaf has really dwindled in significance and in influence. So when they start talking about terrorist cells that are based on the Abu Sayyaf, linked with the Jemaah Islamiyah, or linked with the Al-Qaeda, we keep wondering where these cells are. Where is this conspiracy coming from? We don't see it at the community level. We do agree that terrorist cells do exist, but we do not think that the magnitude is there, or that there is this huge conspiracy that links the insurgents in Mindanao with insurgents or terrorists in Indonesia, Malaysia, or the Middle East.
What about a more politically legitimate group such as the Moro Islamic Liberation Front? The Philippines government is currently negotiating with this group for peace, while the US government is reportedly considering putting the Islamic Liberation Front on its list of terrorist organisations. First of all, is the Moro Islamic Liberation Front in any way a terrorist organisation?
Definitely not. The Moro Islamic Liberation Front, an insurgency group that's fighting for political rights, for property rights, has support from the communities because they are fighting for interests that will serve the Muslim communities. However, the methods that they have used to implement their war strategies have always engaged government troops. They have never attacked civilians. And that is a major difference. I have had some conversations with officers of the American government, and I don't get the impression that they're really going to be coming out and tagging the MILF as terrorists. What they are cautioning, however, is the practice of some of the MILF troops to work with troops that are associated with the Jemaah Islamiyah. I think what's happening is this. If I am a rebel and you are a rebel, you come to me and you need some assistance, definitely rebels and rebels are going to come together. But that is a far cry from saying that the leadership of the MILF and the leadership of the Jamaa Islamiya are colluding in some grand strategy to create a region of instability. I don't think that that's happening.
Amina Rasool, Director of the Philippine Council on Islam and Democracy. And that's it for this week. You can find a transcript and podcast of today's program on our website at abc.net.au/religion. Choose the Religion Report from the program list, and you'll also find lots of links and information about today's stories. Thanks to producer Noel DeBean and technical producer John Diamond. I'm David Rutledge. Bye for now.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.